Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Aloha, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Anthropology, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm Alex Golub, and I will be the host of the channel today. So today we're going to be talking to Amelia Skushpek. Please, Amilka, tell me if I did justice to your last name there. She's the author of Revealing the Invisible Mine, Social Complexities of an Undeveloped Mining Project. And I should say, Amilka and I have known each other for quite some time. So we're going to, I'm going to call her Amilka. She's going to call me Alex. But if you want to Google the book, Amelia is the official first name and the last name too. Just remind me, can you say it for the record, what your full name is so I can give you some respect on that front, Amilka?
Sure, of course. It's Amelia Skushpek.
Thank you so much. I apologize for doing the best I could on that.
You did a great job.
Thank you. So I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about how it is that you came to write this book. For people who have not had a chance to read it, it's an account of a group of people in a relatively rural area of Papua New Guinea and their interactions with a mining company where the mine has not actually opened yet. They're still doing the initial work to decide whether the mine should open. So we'll talk more about the content of that book, but I guess one of the first questions is, how did you come to write this book and how did you get all of the way to this rural area of remote Papua New Guinea? This is really not a local field site for someone who's originally from Europe and did their field work in the UK.
Yes, I think it's a tricky question to answer in a way, because I feel now like everything I have ever done has been kind of leading up to this book. And the strict story of it is I did sustainable development in my previous academic life and was fascinated by the ideas of corporate social responsibility. And then, you know, emerged from this immersion in undergraduate and honors course with the thought that I still have no idea what those terms actually mean. They are clearly very powerful, very meaningful to a lot of people. And I really wanted to do a very detailed study on the meaning and application of those terms and their effect. And I suppose then a little bit by accident, I ended up in the field of anthropology and never really looked back. So I have started a master's program that is going back many, many years ago at the University of St. Andrews. And I was here at a very fortunate time where Jamie Winner was a visiting professor and was talking a lot about his experiences. And Tony Crook is in the department. There is a very strong Pacific presence here. So over time, I've decided to narrow down my focus on mining, thinking what a fantastic context to be looking at sustainable development in and focus area that is ultimately very, very unsustainable. And I initially wanted to study one of the projects in South America. And then just because life works mysterious ways sometimes, Andrew Mutu, the current director of the National Museum in Papua New Guinea in Port Moresby, came to St. Andrews and was talking about this big project, this anticipated project that has been in the making for decades, and really talking about the lack of information and the need for research and sold it as a very fascinating site. So that was me sold. that has kind of decided the field project, and this is how I started my adventures and my experiences and my work in Papua New Guinea.
So maybe we could fill in some of the details for this area. You know, studying mining in Papua New Guinea, which is something that you do and I do, it's a sort of a difficult thing for some people who don't work in the country to wrap their heads around, because on the one hand, you're working in an area that is, quite remote. That's a term that has a sort of a negative connotation, and some people would feel a colonial history, but I mean, this is a remote area. And you're using some themes in this book that are really classical anthropological themes, but you're studying mining, which is a very modern topic. So maybe we should just talk a little bit. This is the Frida Mine, or the potential Frida Mine. And it's located in, remind me, the province?
So the mine is located on the border between East Sipik Province and Sandaun Province in Papua New Guinea, right there on the borderline.
And this is a really mountainous region where some people have done a lot of work before. There's a famous article, famous to us, by Dan Jorgensen, which documented the emergence of landowners and mining politics in this area.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's geographically a very striking place. So it's right there where the Sipik Plains meet the mountains. So it's spectacularly beautiful, but also, as you say, quite remote. The history of the project itself goes back to the 1960s, when the deposits were first recorded there during a geological sampling exercise. So really, this is where the story of the project begins in the kind of official and formal timelines. And it's one of the multiple timelines that I'm following through in the book. But from the very beginning, one of the challenges for this particular project was that area in which it is located, and the actual deposit is in Sandaun, has experienced decades extensive tribal warfare, local warfare. The group territorial boundaries, if you can call them that, have changed and shifted numerous times. Some groups went extinct, other groups emerged as a result of that upheaval. And as you know, any mining company wanting to operate in Papua New Guinea and, you know, anywhere else for that matter, one of the challenges for them is to identify the landowners, right? Identify who is it that is the custodian of the ground, and who are ultimately the stakeholders in the sense of people that companies need to engage with and identify in the project area.
Yeah. So this might be a little bit different from some people's imagination, where there is a group of indigenous people, they've been on the land for a long time, and they're opposed to mining. This is an area where there's a lot of movement, there's a lot of migration and warfare, and people want the mine to open because for them it's the only way to get development. Is that a fair thing to say?
I think it's a very fair thing to say, and I think a lot of people find it very surprising. So in most conversations I have about my work, and when I talk about Frida and about that project, the most common response I get is, you know, it's a great thing you're there, this, you know, you can help stop this mine because, you know, people don't want it. And it is not exactly true. It's a very complex situation, complex process. A lot of the people in the project area have very limited access to basic services and to civic infrastructure, and have kind of grown up with this understanding that the mining project and mining development is for them the way to get access to those things which they associate with development. So be it public services, schools, or, you know, access to cash economy, education and employment. So there is certainly a lot of support and a lot of factors that mean that local communities, including Payamo, are working actively with the mining companies. Of course, they have their own reservations. Of course, there's a lot of kind of politics happening there, and they're trying to stand ground on certain decisions. But overall, the sense is that mining is desirable precisely because of that kind of sense of abandonment by the state of Papua New Guinea and lack of access to things that, you know, I think we tend to take for granted.
Yeah. So I think if people Google, there have been some reports that have been very concerned about the potential environmental impacts of this mine. But here for people on the ground, this is sort of their chance to get schools, roads, hospitals, and other stuff, which they feel like the government is not providing.
It is. And I think geography, in a way, helps there in that the communities that live very close to the proposed project location, they also own grounds up the hills, up the mountains, further up. So the way in which they perceive the negative environmental impacts, and they are aware that those negative impacts will come as much as they can be, having not experienced them. One of the kind of lines of argument is that they will be able to move to the higher ground and maintain their access to hunting grounds and to fishing grounds and avoid some of that environmental risk and impact. Of course, the same cannot be said for communities further down the river. Frida River is located in a very ecologically sensitive area in a tributary of the Sipig River system. Sipig River, over 1,000 kilometers long, a very, very rich, both in terms of diversity, biodiversity, but also in kind of culture sense and diversity of people who live there, most of whom rely on the river for their livelihoods. And therefore, there is an awful lot of concern from those people further down the river about the environmental impacts should anything go wrong up on site.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of the discussion we've been having so far is about anticipating what could happen when the mine is built. And it seems to me like this is one of the major themes of your book, you know, that the book is about the Frida mine. But of course, there is no mine. The mine is something that's going to happen in the future. And that the title of the book is Revealing the Invisible Mine. So can you tell me a little bit about what it is like to study a mine when there is no mine and what your argument is about what it would mean to reveal a mine that's currently invisible?
I think it's, on the one hand, it's very clear this mine is not there. It's an advanced exploration project. It has been in exploration stages for decades now. There is no mining infrastructure. There is no mining pit. There is nothing being constructed there that we would associate with a big mine. And I think, you know, the revealing the invisible mine is both my attempt in this book to show different perspectives and to show ways in which this mine is being revealed to the people, or they are hoping to elicit this big revelation of where the mine arrives. But in a way, I think it's also reflective of my own kind of journey writing it when I arrived very much, so there isn't a mine here. But over time, I started really questioning, what is a mine? Because the local communities, the way they talked about it, and they talked about the mine, they talked about Frida, was very different to this clear-cut differentiation of a mine life cycle project used by the mining company and the government representatives to differentiate between those different stages. So I think one of the arguments what I'm challenging the readers of this book to imagine is, what if this mine is there, it just hasn't revealed itself? And if so, what is the mine, right? And I think this is to me, this is one of the main themes in this book, is asking a question, studying a mine in those very early pre-mining, pre-construction context. What is it that is actually being studied, and what is it that is being discussed?
Yeah, I mean, the way that you describe it in the book, the Payamo people who are the hosts, or I guess the landowners of the mine, have this sense that the mine is there and has not been revealed. You said earlier that according to one timeline, the mine started in the 1960s with some prospecting work, but they have their own timelines and their own theories about the mine's creation and when it was created, which is different from that.
It is very different. It is very different, and it goes all the way back to the time of first ancestors who have traveled the lands and who started the different groups in the area. And it goes back to the mythology of those ancestors and gifts they left behind, what it has since already been revealed to people as those massive gold and copper deposits that are being guarded and looked after also to be demonstrated in the form of mining, in form of development when the time comes. So there is a lot of a sense of, yes, you know, those minerals are already there. There is local mythology and stories about how those minerals ended up there, who brought them there. It wasn't a coincidence. It was a form of a gift, a form of a lineage there, which means that to them, you know, the talk about mine follows very different temporalities. And when I put forward to them, you know, when I arrived, and I said, okay, but, you know, I hear that this mine doesn't exist. The sense I got is for a lot of those people, most of them were born after the exploration has started. Most of the people who are actively involved with the mine grew up already in the shadow of this project that doesn't yet physically exist. And for them, it's very difficult to kind of understand and conceptualize how something that has already changed their reality and their world and has had such a great impact cannot yet exist.
Yeah, it's had an effect. You use this term effect a lot, which I think sort of traces back to your genealogical influences and the work of Marilyn Strathern and others. That the mind must exist in some sense because it shaped people's lives. This process of preparation for the mine has taken literally decades. So it's become the mine, or the future mine, or maybe the invisible present mine, has been the sort of the narrative which has shaped the life in the area for decades.
Yes, I think it very much is. And I think this is my academic genealogy, as you referred to it, also has influenced, you know, the Strathernian kind of school of thinking through perspective of relations, right? And one of the theoretical groundings emerging from that school of thought here is what if we look at a mine as a social relation, right? Rather than as an economic project, as an industrial and infrastructural project, how then can we study that thing, right? The mine as a social relation.
Yeah, the valuable thing about that perspective is that it lets you take people seriously when they say things like, you know, the ancestors have put gold in the ground. There would be many approaches to mining which would just say like, oh, that's a clever story, but obviously not true because we have geologists who know how this was formed. But your perspective allows us to understand not whether those statements are true and false in their denotational contents, but how those statements sort of create roles or elicit relationships between local landowners and the company of a certain sort. And the purpose of the statements is as much to create those relationships, or I guess relations they're called, as it is to accurately describe the formation of ore bodies or the distant past.
Yes, and I think, you know, the purpose of the stories is to create relations, but also, you know, it's a two-way system. So it's kind of this ongoing reframing and experimentation, right, with social structures, with affiliations, with lineages, with ancestral stories. All of this is kind of ongoing and in a constant state of flux.
Yeah, the flip side of creativity is instability. And there's a strong sense, I think, in a lot of PNG that if you fix meaning once and for all, then you're going to create winners and losers. And that's a downside in a place where you value egalitarianism. So in this situation, one of the things that people are doing is they're not just trying to repurpose their old stories for the current moment, where they take, you know, mythological tales and say, oh, we can now use these tales to be officially listed in a book as landowners. They're reinterpreting the tales, tell me if I get this right, to recognize that the true meaning of the tale is not what they thought, but it now has a new meaning that's been revealed to them because of the present circumstance. So they're constantly understanding for the first time what they would say is an old meaning was in the present. Am I getting that right?
Yes, you are, maybe with the exception of for the first time. I think it might be more close better described as understanding again. I think, you know, a lot of those stories are kind of living stories. So it's not that this is the first time they see the meaning of it. It's the first time they see this meaning of it, if that makes sense. But absolutely, it's kind of going back to the stories they've had. It's finding new pathways of interpreting those stories, of finding linkages between stories. And it works, I think, in both ways. It works in a very kind of utilitarian, pragmatic way, in which they're presenting themselves in a particular way to the mining company in order to engage with them in a way that mining companies, you know, are able to do that through those labels of we are the landowners, we are the impact community. But I think it kind of also works on this very kind of internal basis, right? And kind of internal politics and trying to learn more about themselves and explain themselves and things that happened to them and that have happened to them through those stories.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you represent yourselves to others, it's not just because you want them to have a certain kind of knowledge of you, but also because you want yourself to be seen as a certain kind of person, or you want your community to be seen as a certain kind of community. So there's a kind of moral regard that you're sort of hoping when you make yourself a subject in this way for other people to look at. And in the case of the Payamo, Payamo, thank you. You know, one of the things that I think you deal with in this book very well is insisting on the one hand that there's been a huge radical change in their lives from being remote people in a subsistence area of Papua New Guinea to sort of suddenly, and you know, dealing with the forefront of modern capitalism, and that's a huge change. But then at the same time, you want to try to stay away from extreme narratives of first contact or, you know, total radical change, which underplays like their agency and their ability to understand what's happening to them. So I guess part of the way that they represent themselves to others is also their own attempt to grapple with the social changes that they've been introduced to.
I think you're absolutely right there, and I think it's a way in which they're using their frames of reference, right, to understand and to explain to themselves things that emerged outside of that frame of reference that have appeared and arrived. I think in writing this book, and it took me a very long time to write it and to find the right way to tell the story, acknowledging that there is no single right way. I think it was incredibly important for me to, on the one hand, show them as this group that has always been changing, has always been evolving, and I have been through some dramatic experiences in the past, such as the tribal warfare. But at the same time, highlight just the magnitude and the scale of changes that they have experienced in the relative recent history in the context of mining and of industrial development that they are anticipating and that they're discussing on a daily basis.
Mm. Yeah, I think for a lot of people who study the mining industry in Papua New Guinea, this issue of how you represent yourself to a bureaucratic force such that you can be a suitable recipient of benefits is a big issue, because it almost always involves sort of shaping yourself for that force when what existed before, you know, really did not quite fit the mold. So one of the things they're doing is they're trying to meet the expectations, something like that.
Very much so. And you know, and you mentioned that article by Dan Jorgensen earlier, and it developed some of those themes, right, about how it will always prove possible to find those landowning clans or whatever categories we apply here, particularly if people have interest in making it happen, right, in presenting themselves in that particular form. I think one thing that really fascinated me in the field was how, on the one hand, they had to present themselves as this very neatly structured, right, an entity. But on the other hand, the there was this acknowledgement that this is just our presentation, and yes, it will change again, and yes, this will happen. And I write in a book about the document that PIMO prepared a few years back to do precisely that. It's called the Big Book of PIMO Sane, and it presents this incredibly fluid and complex social group in terms of family trees, in terms of delineation of clans. But if you look very closely in the acknowledgements or in the opening of the document, which sets it out that this is the facts, right? This is the truth and the facts of the matter. It does say there that, you know, but we reserve the right to update this and to change this, which I think creates this really nice interplay if you're looking at the same thing from the perspective of, say, a mining company or a government official for whom it's a document that reflects facts and they take it at a face value and for granted. Whereas for the PIMO, this document is very different. It shows of their capacity to present themselves in a way and in almost kind of enter and invite the company into particular kinds of engagements and relations. But at the same time, they know that this is kind of a snapshot at one point in time for one particular purpose, right? So it's incredibly interesting from an anthropological perspective to study documents and how they are interpreted and what they mean in those contexts.
Could you maybe spell that out a little bit more? So on the one hand, the company sees that this book has a set of, I guess it's maybe you would call it a kind of knowledge, an accurate knowledge of who the PIMO are. But for the PIMO, it's the book is proof of their ability to move the company, to make the company open the mind. For them, it's not so much about the knowledge that's in it, but about the relation that's in it. Could you maybe spell that out for people who are not familiar with this concept of relation and elicitation and effect?
I think it is about both those things. So on the one hand, the book does present stories that are very important ancestral narratives that have been present for a while and are, you know, shifting every so often, but speak to the core of the PIMO history and who they are and how the world came to be. And certainly, you know, there is, if you're assessing the kind of the factuality and whether this a document shows correct information insofar as it talks about people who are there and insofar it talks about the names within the community of different groupings and lineages, that information is very much there. But I think that the purpose of it was, on the one hand, to present that information, but on the other hand, to present it in a way in which that knowledge could be made effective. I think in every context, when you have a lot of different stakeholders looking for different kinds of knowledge and different kinds of information, and they figured it out, you know, over the past 60 years, that telling this incredibly long, complex, ancestral story interrupted with songs, as they might do in the evenings in Paupe, in the village houses, will not have the same effect and the same kind of not so much importance, but the same understanding if they try to present it to company officials, you know, people who don't have that intimate knowledge of their sociality, of their relations, of their world there. So I think it's trying to do both. And certainly there is a lot of talk in Paupe about capacity and about their ability to engage with companies, plural, because there have been many companies involved in the project over the decades, and with the government in a way that receives some kind of affirmation, right? Positive response. Yes, we have heard you. Yes, we know this is what you're saying here.
Yeah, there's a kind of recognition politics, which is both about the political economy of trying to get resources, but also there's a kind of morality. They want to be recognized as being the kind of people that they believe themselves to be by the outsiders. Is that right? There's a kind of a moral thing or some dynamic of recognition there. Am I right?
I would say you're right in that there's certainly this kind of moral theme to that recognition. There is also, you know, quite a clear political theme to it. And as I write in the book, There is, and I should mention, for clarity, the Payamo are not the only community, the only group in that area. They are not the only impact community of the project. There are landowners just outside of the main project kind of area where the deposits are, where the pit is. There are two other groups, the Mianmin and the Telefomin, both of which are much more numerous. And Telefomin, of course, have experiences as well in the Octedi mine and mining over Tabubil side, which informs, I think, a lot of their strategies. So there seems to be this competition for recognition between those three groups. Right. Mm. So there's an element of local politics in all of this. And when the document was written and when the document was presented, the local Payamo leaders repeated very clearly a couple of times that one of the great things about this document is that they are the first ones to present their knowledge that way. That I even though the Telefomin are much more numerous and you know, have much more kind of educated members of community in the kind of formal education sense, that they are the ones who've managed to make it happen. And to pull through that relational theme, they are the ones to make it happen because they were able to mobilize a relationship with a person who is from the area, who has kinship links with the Payamo, but who was working in Brisbane and had access to GIS and technologies and was able to help them in that process.
Yeah, and one of the things I noticed in what you said a bit ago is that it's what one of the focuses is really what effect the knowledge has. So the book was important because it would have an effect when the knowledge was presented, not necessarily that the book sort of contained the final definitive account of the Payamo. So that notion of effect is central.
The notion of effect is central, and it kind of, you know, loops back into this notion of revelation, right? In that, in that, all those attempts to present knowledge, all those engagements, and their entire entanglement with the Frida River project, things happen, and people talk to them. So those events took place, but we don't know what they mean. We don't know if they were meaningful. We don't know. How are we to know in the present until we see the effects of them and we'll be able to fully understand at some point in the future or maybe possibly never?
Yeah, so there's this sense that you have all of this stuff that happened in the past and you think you know what its relevance has been, but now it might be relevant in some other way. It might have some other effect in the other way. And when you realize that it can create a mine or it can entice a mine into being created, suddenly you realize that that was the meaning all along. You don't see that as an innovation in meaning where you're repurposing these things for a new purpose. You see yourself as recovering the original meaning. Is that right?
Or you know, realizing that there was something that was always there. It just remained hidden from you. This is, I think, the way in which they're thinking about this mine as well. You know, it is there. It's just hidden from them.
Yeah. So there's this, I'm sorry, I'm trying to do this from my framework here, my mental framework, which is not theirs or yours. So there's this sense in which that when they find out that these myths are about gold rather than some other thing that historically they were about, they realize that it's been revealed to them that that was the meaning of the myth all along, or a part of the meaning all along, and it's already been revealed to them. So what we might think of as an innovation in meaning or a transformation in meaning is to them a revelation of an always present but previously hidden meaning. Is that right?
That is okay. Correct. That is my interpretation. Okay. That is my interpretation of it, and this is how I came to understand it. I think, you know, in this book is as much, you know, the story of the project, and I did my best to make sure that it reflects my experiences in the field and presents it in a way that is has great integrity, also the kind of research integrity. But I think, you know, it's also inevitably, as every book is, it is in a way my story of learning about those things and of of figuring those things out, which I think
Yeah, I guess some people might say, you know, Amilka, you don't have to be humble and say that this was just your story. This has actually always been the story, but you're just now realizing it.
I think so, and you know, and I do use that one particular occasion in the book when one Pastor Jacob, one of the local leaders, you know, talks to me for the first time about this Book of Payamo that this person in Brisbane is putting together, and then he says to me, "But you know about it? You've already seen it." And I was going, "It's like, no, I don't know. I've never heard about this. I have never seen it." And it wasn't until much later that I remembered that a few months back, he did show me some pieces of paper, right? Some kind of loose documentations and diagrams, not explaining to me at the time what they were. But yes, I have seen it. I just didn't know it. I did not realize that I did.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things that's valuable about the book is that you're able to really understand the logic, or cultural logic, I guess you might say, that's behind so many of the things that these landowners do, rather than sort of just doing like what I might think of as a more political, economic, or a more sociological account, which I think in my own work, maybe I'm a little guilty of, where you don't really have the capacity to delve deeply and to understand what is going on in terms of some of the deeper cultural logics at play. For instance, I was struck, you say in the book that, you know, there are these ancestral mythological figures who have public names and secret names. And then it turns out that they will tell the company the secret names, or they will say the secret names sometimes, but it doesn't matter because the company know the name, because they don't know how to use the name right. And I thought, you can correct me if that's not an accurate understanding of the story, but this idea that you could know the name, but it still wouldn't be efficacious because you didn't know how to use it, or you weren't aware of the deeper meaning. I thought that is really, that's not how I think about names. And I thought you were able to make sense of that in a way that was powerful.
Thank you. Yes, I think, you know, it talks about, and I go into quite a bit of detail about this in the book, about knowledge practices, and it goes all the way back to the kind of cult houses and traditional religions. But there is an element of, you know, of the kind of utterance in terms of a form of a word, right? A form of a name that on its own doesn't really mean much and cannot really do much unless you either know the meaning behind it or have the relationships that can kind of make it more effective. So in this context, when you're talking about the Masalai, the land spirits who are present in the landscape, and who all quite rightly have two sets of names. They have those hidden names and those public names. But the hidden names can also be revealed to people who don't know that they're powerful. I think it's all about ability to recognize value that only comes with a certain level of immersion and care and time spent and you know understanding of what's happening behind, you know, below the surface and behind all of that. And to be honest, you know, I was reflecting about it a little while ago. It was my experience with those stories, with the hidden names, and I allude to it in the book, is that when I first arrived and, you know, I was very much somebody from the outside, and it is a remote area, you know, the visitors, especially people who, you know, are prepared and willing and wanting to live and learn with the people, are not very common. So initially, people would come to me and tell me those hidden names without thinking twice about it. But the longer I lived there and the more I figured out about the knowledge systems, about what those names actually entail, what kind of meaning they carry and the power they carry within them, when people started to notice that I was realizing all those frameworks, suddenly those names were becoming hidden to me again, right? except for my kind of core, for the Melefale, which is one of the lineages in the community and the people that I lived with and interacted with the most because of sharing households. So there is certainly this element of what is being said to whom in the kind of relational terms, but also this very and in the book, you know, I talk about Frederick Barth and Tony Crook and Roger Lochman and their kind of interpretations of what a secret is, and I arrived at the I stated a claim here that my focus has shifted from what the secret is to what the secret does. I think that became to me a much more exciting ethnographic question in that context, including the secret names of the land spirits.
Yeah, we're back to that concept of effect, it seems. Yeah, it's really interesting.
We are. I think, you know, this is the theme running through the book, but I think it's also representative of my experiences there, watching the Payamo interacting with other people, with other members of other communities, with the company, with the government, but also the way in which they tried to teach me about their world, right, and give me glimpses to it and help me understand. Even though I have to admit, sometimes it was very clumsy when I look back at it, and I would ask questions which they were very surprised by. They were like, you know, why would you ask that question? This question is. It's not important here. It's totally insignificant here. So it was a privilege to learn from them, but I'm also very grateful for their patience with me as I tried to figure those things out.
You know, I should say, actually, I hadn't thought that we would hit this topic, but it is worth saying that you're very reflective in the book. You often begin the chapters taking readers in with a story where you're present and you're talking about your host family. We get to know them. We recognize their names across chapters. You are willing to describe yourself as a fallible person who sometimes makes mistakes. I think at one point you talk about being ill, you know? So I mean, one of the things that really struck me about the book was your ability to, on the one hand, deal with these very obscure and abstract analytic terms like relations, transformations, and revelations, but at the same time, it gives you a sense of being there in that Clifford Geertzian sense, and the photographs are also marvelous. I have to say, I did not know that you were such a skilled photographer.
Oh, thank you very much. I think it's a combination of two factors. I think any field work like this, any research project like this, it's a big event in an academic career, but it's also, you know, a very important moment in a person's life, right? It carries that significance there. So I think it's very difficult to remove oneself from writing about it. I don't necessarily think it would be very responsible of me to remove myself from it. So what I strive to do in the book, and you know, there's a couple of moments there when I say, like, look, this is how I understand it, but I'm also trying to provide reader with enough kind of ethnographic material for them also to be able to come to their own conclusions, right? And to figure out for themselves what it is that was happening there. So I suppose, yeah, one is this kind of self-reflection and placing myself in the book is inevitability of that research and writing process. But also, yes, it was in a way an attempt to bring those people closer to the reader and to help the reader see them as people. Not kind of subjects of study, and not something that is kind of detached in any way, but as fellow human beings, you know, and wonderful ones at that.
And it can be difficult in this area. We have not talked too much about this, but when we talked earlier about warfare and extinction, I mean, this is an area where people would kill and eat each other, so. In many ways, one of the difficulties of doing research in this area is portraying people as human when they do things which we normally associate with the most outlandish and exoticizing kind of anthropology. This is an area where these kinds of things happen. So that's always something that you you have to reckon with when you write from this perspective where you're trying to show people in their full humanity, I guess.
Yeah, and I'm not trying to sugarcoat it in this book. And I talk about individual figures in the community who were famed for being warriors and everything that kind of entailed. But I think my also because in my methodology, it is very much from ethnography, village-based ethnography from the perspective of the Payamo. But in my work, I also made a decision that in order to understand that relationship, and the way in which those different kind of worldviews collide and make sense of one another, I have also done some research work amongst the on the ground company personnel, and interviewed some government representatives as well. And I think in order to do that and to do that again with integrity, I strived to, as much as I could, not to judge, to present things and to talk about things. But not to kind of add value judgments, personal value judgments to those things.
Yeah. I mean, I think you do a good job of being frank in terms of, what you think and what other people think without having to become too moralistic in a way that would sort of show you to be tendentious. I mean, I think one of the things that theory allows you to do is to avoid making difficult decisions about how you represent people. If you write in your ethnography, the Payamo often talk to me about how they could elicit relations through transformations of knowledge. I'm just like, I guarantee you, no one ever, while you're drinking tea in the morning, someone says, Amilka, I was just thinking about eliciting relations. Like, that's not what people actually say, but it's always much easier to use that language to get away from making some of the tough decisions about writing the book and saying things like people want a mine, and in some sense don't have a lot of agency, but then in some other sense they are active agents of their history. And so I think being willing to do that thick description work, especially naming individuals who are going to have access to this book at some point, that takes a certain amount of integrity or a willingness, I guess, at least to make mistakes.
Yes, I think one of the processes or moments in this book writing process, I was very fortunate in that a couple of years ago, I was able to take a draft of the book with me to Paupe. And spend a lot of time sitting, outside the house in a publicly accessible place, going through the draft and going through the manuscript, and as much as I could, translating the ethnography. The theory parts were more difficult to kind of engage and translate in those contexts, but I did my best to say, so this is what I write, and this is the kind of material, and this is some of the conclusions that I'm drawing here, which was on the one hand a petrifying process because I was half expecting people to turn around and say, oh, you got it all wrong. That would be the greatest nightmare. Fortunately, they didn't. They were quite excited, and it was stressful, but I think incredibly important moment for me as well. Taking the work that they have all contributed to back to them in the first instance before publishing it and sending it out to the big wide world.
Mm. And in the future, because there could potentially be a mine there, your descriptions of these ways of life could be precedential and in court cases or negotiations, and hence have a tremendous monetary and just psychological and personal force in shaping the community's future. So you had to be aware of those potential possibilities and the way in which this writing could be taken up in the future in the way that, something written about myth in a rural place where your subject is not going to suddenly be worth hundreds of millions of dollars really would not have to grapple with.
Yeah, so I think doing my best, but also in the writing process, I think every person who's preparing a manuscript, there's countless decisions to be made about what to put in, what to take out. There were certain things that emerged during my field work that I thought were inappropriate for the book, or I was explicitly asked not to not to put in, but that people wanted me to know about those, which again is just part of the building that story. And I agree with you. I think in the context when we are talking about one of the biggest undeveloped gold and copper deposits in the world, we are talking a project that if it takes off, you know, there's going to be a huge amount of money at stake. And there is going to be a lot of contestation, no doubt, about how to distribute this money. I'm fully aware that that this work, this book, and those stories might be used also in ways that I cannot control. Right? I mean, anyone can pick it up now. So there is a sense of responsibility there, which is why, you know, it is so important for me to take it back to the community and make sure that they also feel comfortable with me talking about certain things.
Yeah, or at least they feel comfortable with you talking about certain things now. You know, one of the themes of your book is the way that people discover hidden meanings in works through time. And one of the things maybe that anthropologists are tempted to do is to try to fix the meaning of the text in some way that they think is appropriate. But then they find out that in the future, its hidden meaning gets reinterpreted all the time. So, you know, it might be that 5 or 10 years down the road, people suddenly decided that they did not always want all along for this to be portrayed this way or that way. And I guess in some sense, that dynamic of revelation and innovation / recognition of pre-existing knowledge, depending on how you want to look at it, that's something that ethnographers or anybody who writes nonfiction has to deal with as much as the Paimo do when they're trying to make themselves legible to the mind.
Absolutely. So I think, you know, one of the ways in which I tried to deal with it in my own thinking about this text and writing is to present that material as something that is, you know, kind of in flux and in motion, and to allow for that to evolve, right, with the people and with future events. And as you say, those things will be reinterpreted. The changes in Paupe, in Paimo at the moment also mean that the elder leaders are mourning the lack of interest from the younger people with regards to their tradition and some of those stories. And one of the leaders, when I was in Paupe last a couple of years ago, said to me afterwards, it's like, you know, make sure some of the copies are here, because if the youngsters are no longer interested in our stories, then at least when they grow up and they become wiser and they start developing interest, they'll be able to read it and they'll know what we told you.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, your book is kind of like the Big Book of Paimo in that it has, you know, a description of who everybody is. But of course, that could always be changed or reinterpreted in the future.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, thanks so much for this interview. I don't want to take up too much of your time, but before I let you go, can you tell me a little bit about what your research work has been like since this publication of this book? Do you have any current projects that you're working on?
I do. So since the bulk of my work at Frida, I have done some work at a couple of other mining projects in Papua New Guinea, looking at stakeholder engagement and kind of co-creation on knowledge in engagement scenarios. But most recently, I have actually turned my attention back to Frida, but further down the river, and my current research project is looking at a public response and review of a document produced by the company and submitted to the Papua New Guinean government as part of the mining application process called the Environmental Impact Statement. It's a fascinating document also because it has to assess impacts that have not yet taken place and evaluate impacts of a mine that hasn't yet been constructed. So in my work, I'm looking at the way in which that public review of the document has taken place and what kind of people got involved and how networks emerged around it and what kind of themes emerged through that process.
And do you see some similar dynamics to what you've seen at Frida, where you're sort of continuing to use this revelation framework? Or do you think maybe the different cultural logics down there make things happen in a slightly different way?
Look, I've entered this project very open-minded, in full-on acknowledgement that, you know, it's a different kind of research, it's a different kind of group of people. And this current research also you know, because of the travel restrictions with the COVID pandemic. It's a very kind of different kind of field work. It's mostly online interviews, focus groups. So I'm trying to navigate that terrain and that methodology at the moment, whilst engaging with as many people who took place in the process as I can.
Wow. Amazingly, I forgot about COVID in the process of our being in the Central Highlands of Papua New Guinea. So can you tell me a little bit about that? You're Skyping in or you're Zooming in to rural CPIC headwaters and asking people what they think about environmental impact statements. That sounds fascinating.
I think, you know, I've not started the actual field work yet. It's all been the groundwork and the prep work so far and the stakeholder mapping. So some of it is speaking to, there is a non-governmental organization, an indigenous group called Save the CPIC, who have started a campaign. As part of that campaign, have been vocal in response to the environmental impact statement. So I'm hoping to be able to speak to some of their leaders where technology allows. But it's also talking to politicians involved, talking to some of our colleagues, some expert academics who have conducted independent review of individual chapters. So just drawing the network of people who got involved, why they got involved, what effect they think it has, and ultimately, you know, asking the question about accessibility of the process, and I completely get the irony about accessibility to my research process as well in all of this. But also, you know, if there is one theme that continues through that work, is looking at one event, at one thing from different perspectives, and try to take each one of those perspectives equally seriously. I think my sense at the moment from just doing the groundwork is that the main discrepancy that I can see so far is that the environmental impact statement answers the question of, can this mine be built? This is how it's designed. This is how it's set up. Whereas the public review process answers the question, should this mine be built? Which creates a very interesting dynamic.
Yeah. Wow. Well, it sounds fascinating. I look forward to hearing more about that research. And thank you once again for the book. So Amilka, thank you very much, and I'll let you go.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.